Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Omfith Digital Monetary Institute. I am Philip Middleton, chairman of the Institute, and I'm joined by my colleague Bhavin Patel, but more importantly, we're joined today by Dave Birch, the author of The Currency Cold War and Much Else Besides. Dave is an international guru on digital identity, digital payments. He was there right at the start with Mondex, for example, for those of you with long memories. And he's also the proud minter of the Wessex e-groat, which is being refused in establishments all over the world at the moment. As I say, he's just produced a fascinating, provocative book called The Currency Cold War, which starts really with the story of money and telling us in that story of money, we are at what management consultants call a paradigm shift and the rest of us call a crossroads, where the combination, the confluence of geopolitics, technology, COVID and one or two other things has created a turning point, I think, in the history of currency and in the history of money. So could we start, Dave? Could you just set that scene for us? Is our old friend cash dead, useless, obsolete? Why are we at this magical moment?
Like you said, it's a confluence of things. So we've had the technology for digital cash for some time. I think up until perhaps a couple of years ago, you might have argued that in developed nations, we could probably obtain 80 to 90% coverage using mobile phones and such things. Now, with the advent of Siri and Alexa and voice interfaces, we've now got, I imagine, 99% of the population. And I'm sure we'll be able to come up with one or two ways to close off that last remaining 1%. So the technology is so pervasive, so ubiquitous that the platform, if you like, for digital money is now in place. The business case for it, I think, is complicated. There are two parts to it. One to do with cost savings. Unfortunately, I'm sure you saw the news as I did yesterday that G4S has just laid off 1,000 people in its cash handling branch. And I heard on one radio phone in, I heard somebody who runs a shop saying that having been forced to go cashless for COVID, they weren't going to go back because, frankly, the amount of effort it took to count up the cash and pay for security guards and waste counter space with tills and all this sort of thing has now been thrown into quite sharp relief. So there's a business case to do with saving money for merchants, people, for the economy as a whole. The costs of cash are very diffuse, so people don't really recognize them, but somebody is paying for all of those ATMs and security guards and vans and things, and that's you and me, basically. And I noticed yesterday, it's impossible to tell what things are satirical and what things are the real news, so I genuinely can't remember if I read it in the Daily Mail or the Daily Mash. But I think a government person may have said yesterday that they wanted ATMs within reasonable distance of every household in Britain, which is absolutely insane and potentially as big a waste of money as HS2. So the costs have got out of control. You also have to remember the costs of cash fall very unfairly on the people who are least well off. You and I never see cash from one week's end to the next, and it doesn't make any difference. But for the people who are trapped in a cash economy, it's very problematic. They're the people that have to pay to get to ATMs. They're the people that can't get good online deals for things. They're the people who find themselves excluded from cheap utility switching and all this sort of thing. So the costs of cash are not only high, they're very unfairly distributed on the people who are least well off. So there's the cost side of the equation. But I think more importantly, and certainly I think, you know, this is the message of the Bank of England's consultations on this front, there's the benefit side of the equation, which is naturally harder to imagine because we're talking about things that don't exist yet. But to put it in a kind of very bumper sticker version, cash doesn't have an API and digital money does. So once money goes digital, the idea that people will build interesting new products and services on top of it should create a whole new set of products and services and lead to, in fact, I think the Bank of England's figure before was, I can't remember exactly, but if they replace half of the cash it's a 3% GDP boost or something like that. I can't remember. But I think the dominant part of that is the benefit side rather than the cost side. So the business case has shifted now and COVID has thrown it into relief.
As a citizen, I like cash because, A, it's got a nice picture of Her Majesty the Queen on it, which for me is a reassuring message of sovereignty. This is a fiat currency. This is an expression of national identity. And secondly, it's anonymous. It's private. Nobody's sitting there monitoring what I'm spending or what I'm doing with my cash. I believe the state has a duty to keep on providing that to me. You know, forget about this business case business. You know, it's not particularly cost efficient to provide roads or hospitals. But you know, this is something I expect my country to provide along with frigates, fighter aircraft and hospitals.
Let's take that in three parts. So first of all, yes, banknotes are a pretty expression of jingoistic fervour. And you're certainly correct that my campaign have the Queen replaced by a picture of Sir Thomas Gresham has so far not managed to get out of the starting blocks. But there's nothing much I can do about that. Although I do remember a presentation a few years ago at one of my forums. I had a brilliant woman from the British Museum challenging us about what exactly the British Museum will be displaying 1,000 years from now, since once the batteries have run out on your phone, there's not much to show off in the glass cabinet. As to the anonymity, that is a really complicated topic. I would start off by saying that my back of the envelope calculations are that the amounts of seniorage generated by printing £50 notes are considerably less than the tax gap opened up by those £50 notes. And so while it may be profitable for the Bank of England, I doubt it's profitable for UK PLC. And since the primary function of £50 notes seems to be to subsidise criminal behaviour and making it easier for builders to avoid VAT, I'm not sure how much longer that can carry on. It's the third part of it. So then, do you reserve small denominations for anonymous transfers as a public good? And this is, as you know, this is what economists call the big problem of small change. And it was evident in England a couple of hundred years ago when we made the transition from an agricultural to an industrial economy, the shortage of a circulating means of exchange, because all of a sudden you needed money to pay wages and things you hadn't had before. You found people began making their own tokens, particularly in Wales, actually, because of access to the copper mines in Wales. And you had an industry centred around Birmingham where companies would pay essentially for their own pennies to be produced, which they would use as advertising material, actually, as well as a means of exchange. But once competition came into that market, once you have competition to provide small change, the marginal cost of production, you know, very quickly approaches what you can charge for it, and nobody can make a living out of it. So then eventually the public body has to step in and provide that small change. And this argument might well be true in this case as well. So do we want to allow people to make small transactions in complete anonymity? I don't, because I think the hazards that go with that are not worth the risks. But you could certainly imagine doing that by adopting Kenneth Rogoff's suggestion and stop printing banknotes completely and just have £5 coins. Which would be a great inconvenience to tax evading builders, drug smugglers, corrupt politicians and so on, but actually wouldn't make much difference to the rest of us who never use the stuff anyway. If you're going to replace it completely, then I think the decision about anonymity needs to be an informed public debate, which we're precious. Those are in precious supply at the moment, but it shouldn't be up to technologists to decide where to set the dial on that. So if society says to me, we want an electronic cash system which is perfectly traceable in every respect, and not a sparrow will buy a packet of chewing gum without us knowing about it, I can easily construct that. If you say we want one that operates in complete anonymity and under no circumstances will the government be able to find out what you spent your money on yesterday, well, we can create that as well. That would be a very bad thing, by the way. But the reality is going to be somewhere in the middle. The issue of anonymity, I think, is so important. It has to be set by the outcome of reasonable public, well-informed debate. It shouldn't be for technologists to set the dial on that. If you, the public, if you said, well, actually, we shouldn't listen to the public about things, that's bad. But if you, as an informed, you know, representative of the public said, we should have no anonymity whatsoever, the government should track and trace every transaction, then it's quite easy to build a system that does that. If you say, well, we want a system that provides complete anonymity, not the sort of duff, non-fungible pseudonymity of Bitcoin, but real, unconditional anonymity in all circumstances, well, I can build a system like that as well. But of course, in reality, we don't want either of those extremes. The first one would be disastrous. The second one would be even worse. If you had complete anonymity of electronic money, unconditional anonymity, then you'd have, you know, crime and corruption that would be beyond anything we can imagine now. So somewhere in the middle, you have to set the dial. But my general feeling is that we should go for what I tend to refer to as the smash the glass option of conditional anonymity or pseudonymity. So you can go around spending and basically it's in private. Nobody knows what you're up to, well, except the counterparties. But if you do something wrong, the police can get a warrant and go to somebody, a bank or something, and smash the glass and see the transactions. And I think we're going to end up, well, at least I think we should end up with something along those lines. And actually, it's not really hard to see how you could do that. But let's say you say anybody can open up a Bank of England wallet on their phone, if that's what it's going to be, and you can store £500 in it. But if you want to store more than £500 in it, then you have to show up somewhere with a passport and go through KYC AML. And I'm sure we could get some sort of balance like that. And, you know, if people say, well, yes, but then criminals would open 10,000 accounts and store £500 in each of them, I would say good. Because that's very easy for the giant intelligent super killer robot AI that's going to replace the current regime. It's trivial for it to spot that sort of thing. And actually, it would be a good thing if we had criminals in the system and we could see what they were doing instead of keeping them outside the system and making them use £50 notes where we have no idea what they're doing. And I might add, by the way, one of the stories in the newspapers last week, I couldn't help noticing in England, there was a massive police raid. They arrested 300 people or something because they managed to get into some encrypted chat thing that criminals were using, and they arrested 300 people. And what did they find? Did they find, you know, some Bitcoin cold wallets under the bed, or did they find some prepaid cards? Or no, they found massive great piles of cash, £52 million in cash. So keeping people out of the system in cash, as opposed to getting them into the system and tracking and tracing what they're up to, doesn't seem to me to be the best way to support law enforcement.
And I think you're making an important point here that this is far too important a decision to be left to the technologists alone. Technology can provide whatever solution we want it to be, but there does need to be a public debate and discussion about what we want and why we want it. We're making a case for digital money. Is this a fundamental duty of the state? Or indeed, should Dave Birch and the Wessex e-groat be allowed their time in the sun as well? What do you see as the balance between, and of course this question being raised in Trump's by Libra last year, which really put the cat amongst the metaphorical pigeons?
It's a very good and it's a difficult question, Philip. I need to engage with more different points of view and evolve a more rounded position.
Which is what the DMI is for, Dave.
But you're right. It's correct. There is an ethical and moral framework to this that it's very difficult to get the right input to at the moment. Imagine a situation where in a post-Brexit nationalistic project forged in the white heat of new technology and as a surefire means to regenerate the British economy and to extend British soft power abroad, the Chancellor wisely decides to hire me to create the new digital sterling that will revolutionise financial services. You know, stranger things have happened. Should that be the only digital currency? And my answer to that is, I think, no. The reasons why the state wants to make sure that transactions can take place is evident, because we want trade, the basis of our prosperity. We want exchange. Should the state restrict that only to state money? I think that's a step too far. The Hayekian view, which you should allow banks to offer competing currencies so they would compete to keep the value of the currencies up, is a valid view. I'm more of a de bono man myself. I don't see why that privilege should be restricted to banks. And I think, you know, the modern world would show that the amount of money that's out there in the form of M0 is, you know, insignificant compared to the amount of money that's out there in the form of assets of one form or another. But for an individual person, the proportion of their wealth that's in the form of money is actually vanishingly small. So the idea it should be restricted to banks seems wrong to me. So if it's not going to be restricted, I mean, obviously there have to be laws, a la Wirecard, which says if you're going to issue money, you have to have certain balance sheet and you have to follow certain rules and blah, blah, blah. But within that, I might well decide as an individual that actually I prefer to use Islamic money, or I prefer to use Manchester City money, or indeed, as you mentioned earlier on, I prefer to accumulate Wessex groats because they're the only means for paying my property taxes in Wessex. There's all sorts of reasons why people might prefer money that's more closely related to other forms of community and forms of community that share certain values that they share. So in other words, the reason I would use Manchester City money is not because it's economically advantageous to use it over sterling. It might be exactly the same. It might even be worse. Who knows? I use it for other reasons because I want to accumulate it because it's good for the club. Maybe there are certain communities where you can only pay for things in Manchester City money and so on and so forth. That is a sort of back to the future kind of thing. And the argument against local currency, apart from the fact that in a great many cases, local currencies were a sort of hippie affectation that were derided as babysitting tokens rather than viable alternative basis for an economic system, is that the complexity of messing around with different banknotes and bits of paper and whatever was obviously a ridiculous friction. You know, you could hardly expect shops to hold 50 different kinds of notes. But when you move into this world of digital currency and mobile phones, it isn't anymore. When the choice between sterling and Manchester City money is just a menu on my phone, that takes us into a very different world. So should the state provide central bank backed money to ensure that trade can take place? Yes. And I'm sure you've spoken to people who are actual economists rather than people dabbling around in it like me that would have said the same thing. Should that be restricted to be the only mechanism? That's not obvious to me. You know, I'm perfectly happy to be persuaded one way or the other, but I just say it's not obvious to me.
Which there are state-backed fiat currencies and a host of other means of digital exchange buzzing around. And of course, the state-backed economists would say, well, hang about, that creates the most enormous threat to financial stability, because I don't know what's backing the Wessex groat. And if the Wessex groat suddenly vanishes because Dave Birch shuts up shop and goes off to Acapulco, an awful lot of grannies in Wessex are suddenly dependent now on the state for their bread. The problem clearly in the 19th century with a proliferation of banks all issuing notes, many of which suddenly went fut.
So the problem with wildcat banking was an issue of credit and understanding the credit ratings, and that disappears in a modern informational world. You've just been through an example which shows how all this works, which is the collapse of Wirecard. So because Wirecard's money was governed by electronic money institution regulations, which meant that it all had to be held as a 100% reserve in tier one capital, it means that even when the parent company goes bust, you know, none of the people holding the money, you know, I mean, I don't want to get into whether the FCA should have shut it down for the weekend or not, and it caused an unnecessary panic. But the point is, under the EMI regulations, the money has to be held as a 100% reserve in tier one capital. I wouldn't see what would be any different. So if you have a situation where you have a whole variety of different electronic monies have different asset bases, but any mobile phone in the universe can instantly, within milliseconds, compute the relative value of those baskets, I don't see the problem. You know, if Wessex starts to overissue its currency, but let's imagine in the future we decide to issue a Wessex assignat, which is backed by the value of land in Wessex, just to pick an amusing example. If the market could go to a blockchain or something, or whatever these things are done, and compute that the number of assignats issued exceeded the value of the land held in Wessex, then the market would mark them down instantaneously. I call these the Hayekian versus the de Bonoian. I mean, these are very superficial labels, but you understand what I mean. So should it only be the state? No. Should it only be the banks? No. Should it be anybody? No. Should it be companies that can be regulated in a sane way? Well, probably yes.
I've now moved into a world where physical cash has gone, where the state issues digital currencies of one form or another, which may or may not be stablecoin or fully backed or what have you, where private sector institutions, maybe even individuals, are issuing digital means of payment. And then you say, I think rather intriguingly in your book, that we find ourselves potentially in a cold war in cyberspace, in which Libra, a Chinese digital currency, and a digital euro vie for dominance. Could you speak a little more about that for us, please?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think the actual experiment there is, if different currencies are just different menu items on your mobile phone, and you can essentially choose any currency you want for transactions, then you have to ask which currencies people would choose. And obviously in the book, I chose to frame it in terms of Libra versus DCEP, because I thought that's a nice tension to explore. Private versus public, West versus East, transparent and opaque, and all this sort of thing. So, but of course, in reality, it's much more complicated. But I think that those illustrate the points quite well.
Yeah.
So then you think, well, okay, let's imagine I'm a farmer in Africa, and I buy my tractors from China, and I buy my fertilizer from China, and I sell my cows or whatever it is to China. And at the moment, I have to get local currency and then change that into dollars. And then I have to send dollars to China, and then they get turned back into yuan. And then, you know, then they send me yuan, and I have to send it somewhere to get it changed into dollars. And then the dollars get changed into my local currency because I'm not allowed to have a dollar bank account, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's an awful lot of friction. So I might well decide, well, I'll just have Chinese digital currency on my phone then. Why not? I'll buy my tractors in Chinese digital currency, and I'll sell my cows in Chinese digital currency, and everybody's better off, except the, you know, the middlemen that were creaming off the foreign exchange. And also, by the way, and I don't want to make it an overly political argument, but obviously everyone's aware of this, there are people far better qualified than I, for example, the former Secretary of the Treasury in America, saying that the US weaponization of the dollar clearing system, I think The Economist called it financial carpet bombing, which is an interesting turn of phrase, has served to put a great many countries in the position of searching for alternatives. I liked Niall Ferguson's phrase for this. He said, there are some countries that find it irksome to agree with these rules, which I thought was a lovely use of the word. There are a great many people who find it irksome, and they'll be looking for alternatives. So those things all come together to suggest that if there is a real competition out there, then actually it will be a sort of cold war, because it will be an extension of competition between, this time, soft powers rather than hard military power, to extend influence around the world. And you can see this balkanization. Other people have talked about this. You can imagine a balkanization of the web turning into a sort of economic balkanization, where you have these different trading zones with actually relatively much less globalization than there is now. So, you know, I'm not an expert on these things at all, but I'm not stupid. And I can see that if there are competitions between different forms of currencies, that has ramifications far beyond the design of mobile wallets.
And of course, it's a strand in the potential breakdown of the Washington Consensus and the economic order we've enjoyed since Bretton Woods and so forth. My colleague Bavin has a question for you.
This is more about just building up what we were just talking about before. It's this space race, as David, you describe in your book, between the US, if you want to say, or the Western sort of central banks, and China. Do you remotely think it's feasible that China will have a flip the switch moment where they will turn their domestic CBDC into something that's cross-border and therefore exert some sort of global monetary influence, same way the dollar has with their renminbi? And secondly, do you think they would want that responsibility, because it entails a lot of economic restrictions? They are still mercantilist, therefore reliant on trade, and therefore the exchange rate is very important to the way the economy is run. So do you think they want this responsibility?
That's a really difficult question to answer. So it's obvious to everybody that reserve currency status isn't just to do with the dollar and dollar clearing have a preeminent position, because not just because of America's reserves and America's trade and America's GDP and all these kind of things. That's one part of it. But it's also because of institutions. It's because of the courts and the financial system that sits behind it and all these kind of things. So becoming a reserve currency is a long-term project. And you're right, you know, you have to be more liquid and all this sort of thing. There are a couple of people I quote in the book who say it is, you know, America and China in digital currency. It is a new kind of space race. I just thought Cold War was a better book title. I think Cold War sells more books than Space Race. But Space Race is a good description, because it triggers technological progress as well as sort of institutional progress. But it isn't just about the currency itself. Again, I don't want to make political points because I'm not qualified to understand all the nuances. But China is embarking on a transformational initiative, the Belt and Road. The idea of a digital currency as a trading currency all along that road, reducing transaction costs for everybody involved, while simultaneously, yes, allowing China to exert some soft power. That to me doesn't seem like a particularly crazy prediction. I think the Chinese pilot of digital currency in the first four cities occurred, and I'm sure the irony wasn't lost on you guys either. That was the same week the US Treasury began printing and mailing out physical checks, many of them to dead people, with the president's signature on them. And I just wonder if those two things together aren't what economists would call a weak signal for change towards the new post-Washington consensus. You know, at the time, it's a small and unremarkable thing, but in the fullness of time, we'll look back on it and see, well, that was basically when things changed.
So let's finally conclude with another thought experiment that sure. The British government has hired the brilliant Dave Birch, and we decide, along with England, to create a wholesale sterling-backed stablecoin token for use in a new regenerated city of London as part of a strategy to differentiate the city, extend the power of sterling as the reserve and trading currency, and generally a sign of the whole new Britain. Do you think that works? Is it something the Bank of England ought to consider, or is it just a thought experiment?
So the idea of a wholesale, I refuse to call it a stablecoin because that's not what it is at all. But the idea of a wholesale central bank token that can be exchanged between institutions to allow for trading without clearing and settlement is in itself not a bad idea. And actually, I can remember probably 20 years ago, post Mondex, Tim Jones suggesting precisely this form of electronic money for the city, a sort of prepaid RTGS equivalent. So why would you do that using tokens? Actually, despite my general ridicule of people who come up with these lunatic blockchain suggestions for things, there is one, I think, reason why you might want to do that on a shared ledger rather than conventionally. And that's because if you look at the example of RTGS, which is without a shadow of a doubt the systemically most important computer system in the whole of the United Kingdom, on which there is literally no expense spared, that's been down twice in the last few years. And when that goes down, that's the British economy reduced to people scurrying around with pieces of paper saying Lloyds owes NatWest £2 billion or something, whatever, however they do it, I don't know. So the idea of having a shared ledger so that each institution that's participating has a copy of the ledger, and that transactions are recorded by consensus in all the copies, but obviously with appropriate encryption so that not everybody can see everybody else's transactions, et cetera, et cetera. And by the miracles of modern cryptography, including cryptographic blinding, homomorphic encryption, and zero knowledge proofs, anybody can establish the liquidity of the system by calculation at any point without being able to read any of the individual transactions, is worth doing because it means there's no system in the middle to go down anymore. If you've just got these ledgers communicating with each other, then if, as seems to be quite often the case, a cleaner pulls out the plug at Lloyd's and all of a sudden the system goes down, it doesn't matter. Lloyds can start using somebody else's copy of the ledger until their copy comes back up. And there is no RTGS in the middle. There's no central system to fail. So I can see the arguments in favour of doing that. What I might be tempted to say to the Chancellor, though, is, look, if we're going to invest the money in building a system that can exchange these tokens between institutions without clearing and settlement, but under the supervision of the Bank of England to ensure that the system is liquid, and, you know, with the appropriate transaction monitoring and giant AI supercomputer killer robots to make sure nobody's up to no good, etc., why would you restrict that just to currency? You know, why not allow the arbitrary definition of tokens to go across that, once again realizing De Bono's vision? Because then if I can send digital assets across that network and central bank money is just one category of those assets, then I think we do have a window into an entirely new kind of financial system, which might be a step change. You know, Carney was very clear. He said it a couple of times about how the purpose of the financial system is to serve the economy and vice versa. If you're going to be cruel about it, you could say the costs of financial intermediation in the economy seem to be relatively static because advances in computers and technology and all that sort of thing have been cancelled out by the costs of AML, CTF, PEP. So basically, it still costs too much. Well, doing it this way, as digital assets being traded on a platform of which Bank of England sterling is just one particular kind of asset, I can see that would have legs. And the reason for doing that, it goes back to this point about, are you trying to save costs or create new opportunities? The crucial reason for adding a digital sterling asset to that system would be so that people can essentially execute smart, they're not smart, contracts, they're not contracts, with one leg of the DVP and central bank money. So I can see lots of reasons why it's worth doing, even though at first glance it might sound a bit stupid. Why would you have some daft blockchain thing that's just for banks to talk to each other?
Well, thank you. And so we come full circle to a wholesale regeneration and restructuring of financial markets infrastructure, both domestically and internationally, which will provide us, I think, with ample subject matter for the next podcast that we do and indeed for your next book. So thank you very much for joining the OMFIF Digital Monetary Institute today for this conversation about the digital currency Cold War. If you've enjoyed it, please join us for future ones, subscribing to us on either iTunes or Spotify. Thank you to Dave, thank you to our team here at the Digital Monetary Institute, and we will see you anon. Thank you.